Hey everyone, welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse, your weekly dose of insider DevOps trends, AWS news, and Terraform insights, all sourced from our SweetOps community, plus a live Q&A you can't find anywhere else. It's August 14th, 2024. I'm your host, Eric Osterman. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We're a DevOps accelerator focused on funded startups and enterprises that helps teams who are overwhelmed with AWS. And we do this by leveraging our over 200 Terraform modules that have been battle tested and downloaded over 100 million times. So no matter where you find yourself on this journey, we are here to help you launch better products faster so you can free up your bandwidth for innovation and nail your value delivery. So if you're curious how we can help you out, just head over to cloudposse.com/meet. Again, cloudposse.com/meet. Answer a few quick questions and you'll book a meeting with me directly. All right, so how can you maximize today's session? Well, first off, our format is very informal. You can engage as much as you'd like, ask questions. And if you're curious about any of our open source modules or tools, just go for it. And for those on the recording, we host these calls live. So you can join us by going to cloudposse.com/officehours. Again, cloudposse.com/officehours. Now, I do have one ask. If you find any portion of today's session valuable, please go ahead and share it with your team. You'll find the recording of this session on our YouTube channel, posted in a couple hours. With that said, let's see what announcements I got here. All right, so the CrowdStrike, the gift which keeps on giving on content. Now, the latest thing that I saw was just another take on it, which was interesting. From the point of view of insurers. So apparently a lot of the policies don't kick in for a certain number of hours, and because the it was patched basically in a certain amount of time, my take was that that meant that it that they weren't liable for covering it. Additionally, even more people don't have cyber insurance, so therefore yeah, they learned the hard way. This was the point. Most policies do not kick in for 8 hours or so after an incident starts. And overall, this was an easier incident to resolve.
I sort of take issue with the this was an easier incident to resolve, because it turned out to be that you ended up needing to build like bootable USBs and like reboot servers onto them and manually remove a file and do all this thing. Like I would be shocked if the percentage was in double digits of companies that recovered from this in under 8 hours. So like that seems crazy to me.
Yeah, that is true.
I just want to see what I was going to say, even if cyber insurance doesn't kick in, people haven't filed their lawsuits yet against CloudStrike, which I'm sure is coming.
Yeah, the other insurance.
yeah. Well, whatever their enterprise value is, essentially, they're going to end up like paying out a lot of money. I mean, I'm sure they're like. Their license probably has some limited, some limited liabilities in it, but people are going to claim that this is, willful misconduct or gross negligence, one of the two, which basically you can't like exclude from licenses or from anything. And then their like insurance is going to have to kick in, or they're going to have to pay out from the company's value, essentially, some large lawsuits I anticipate. Obviously, Matt not being a lawyer and not giving legal advice, I'm speculating on what I think personally will happen. But it's I think we're far from over from hearing the end of this.
And I'm just kind of curious, on insurance policies like that, at that level, obviously that's out of my pay scale or experience. We have a couple $1 million or something, but these companies, do they have, I could imagine they have insurance up to hundreds of millions, but do they have insurance that literally covers up to billions of dollars?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm glad I'm not a shareholder of CloudStrike. That's all I'll say, because I don't think that long term this is going to be good for them.
Yeah. Agreed. All right. Let's see. Next one was something that caught my attention. So attestations are a great way to authenticate basically that a binary or an artifact was created by somebody who at least possesses the private key and another level of security. So, these kinds of signing things have been around for a while, but attestations on GitHub are now a more formalized convention. And there's a documentation on GitHub now how you can leverage that together with GitHub Actions that you can use to do those attestations on your binary artifacts, for example. I think this is something that we should, as a community, start embracing a lot more. I admittedly, we haven't yet adopted this, but now seeing how straightforward it is, I think we should start doing this on all the binaries, for example, that we are the authors for. Then, of course, that only takes you so far. Attestations mean nothing if somebody's not verifying them. So what I'd like to see is then all the, there's a million of these setup actions out there. And those, set up Node.js, set up Atmos, set up Terraform, set up OpenTofu, et cetera. And I'd like to see that these start supporting those attestations so that the setup actions are also validating those binaries. Anyone already using this? All right. Just once. Can you guys hear my son's Lego mania going on behind me? Nope. All right, that's good. Then next announcement. Right, so last week was DEF CON. DEF CON's always a good time. And lots of unexpected hacks came out of that. Here were some highlights from TechCrunch. I'm focusing on a few. If anyone else has some that they'd like to share, I would love to hear those too. The first one I thought was pretty interesting, how they were able to hack the EcoVac. And on the one hand, I think I've been guilty of saying, I really don't care if my Roomba gets hacked. Well, I think I changed my story. This, what an ultimate spying agent. You can just lurk around the house and listen in on conversations and get a video feed. Oh my God, it's like out of a spy novel or spy movie. So that was actually possible. Presumably that's been patched now in the EcoVacs, and you should probably update. The other one, well, go on, Matt. You had something to add on that one?
I was just gonna say, I had an incident not that long ago where I noticed that my Roomba was turning like the it has like a white ring light on it that turns on when it like wakes up and starts doing all of these things. And then I realized that my Roomba was at just random times lighting up, and then seemingly, maybe I was being paranoid, but seemingly whenever I would walk like into its path, it would turn off. So I ended up like factory resetting it because I was a little like worried about what had happened to the thing. And after I factory reset it, it stopped happening. So I didn't know if it was like something nefarious was going on or something. It just got into some weird state. But like I was like really paranoid that someone had hacked my Roomba. So it's kind of funny that this came out.
Yeah, that does sound disconcerting. Yeah, I've noticed that too. I haven't. I don't know if it's just coincidence. I feel like when I approach certain Roombas that I have, that they also light up. They have like some kind of presence, awareness.
Oh, mine was the opposite. I would notice that it was lit up, and when I would walk
Okay.
over by it, the
Oh.
light would turn off.
Yeah.
So I was like, what
That's
the
weird. That is
hell?
weird. Yeah, because the other thing I notice is creep me out sometimes is like it will recorrect sometimes when I'm not expecting it, and that's freaked me out. But yeah, not that. Yeah, that Yeah, we'll hear about that next year's DEF CON. The next one is another one. I do like these kind of vigilante hacker stories where they're going after the bad guys, so to say. This being the Lockbit ransomware group, and they talk about how they've been able to, attack the core infrastructure of these malware companies, and they also were able to actually unmask the identity of the person behind this particular one. There's been similar ones, some great YouTube recordings, people taking down the call center kind of scammers and the phishers. They're pretty interesting to listen to. Anyone have more in this story? All right.
Right.
The next one, what was it?
I was just gonna say the headline about the laser microphones that pick up keyboard taps, like that. That's like that. Maybe not with laser microphones, but like that particular surveillance technique has been around like forever, like since the 80s, where they used to be able to listen. They used to be able to listen to the actual like analog frequency that each key press was making as you typed it. And I know they've changed like a lot with how keyboards are defined and everything. And then I heard that the resurgence of mechanical keyboards that a lot of people have actually like left them open to some sort of like key spying events based on like how those keyboards work. So it's interesting that like things keep resurfacing.
Yeah, everything's cyclical. Well, and I think it's acknowledged somewhere in this article the same that, this is not a new technique. I think one of the things that makes this new is perhaps the exact implementation of it. Also that it's, I think, open source. So making it more accessible.
Yeah, I only read the headline. I didn't read the article, so I'll read it.
And the next one is, oh yeah, this was kind of scary. And it's really interesting if you watch the video. We'll share these links afterwards. They show this attack being exploited. You know how more and more software these days uses AI to suggest maybe the next document you'd like to see, or summarizing a document, or summarizing your questions in real time on the screen somewhere. Obviously, every implementation is different, and what they're using on the back end to do it will vary. But this was specifically targeting Microsoft 365 and OpenAI, and they were able to get to fully bypass the controls in place. And what they could do was basically send, if I understood it correctly, they could send you an email with data with any content in that that they you couldn't see it in the email itself. So presumably it was hidden in HTML tags or using other techniques. And then when the victim would go into, say, Office 365 and ask a question, the data that was in that email that had been sent to them by a bad actor influenced the answers of the suggestions in Office 365. So the example they bring up is wire transfer details. So they sent an email with the attacker's wire transfer details, and then the suggestion in Office 365 for the victim was the attacker's bank transfer details. So yeah, clear case of when things go wrong. I'm probably doing a gross oversimplification here on the overall attack, but that was it in a nutshell.
Yeah, I worked for a company who this has nothing to do with AI, but it's same it's similar. Like someone that I know or the company I worked for, someone sent an email, spoofed the CEO's email address, sent an email to the CFO, and said, I need you to make a transfer for like, $125,000 to this account. I'll get you all the paperwork and everything in the morning, but it needs to be completed by, 2 p.m. or whatever. And it was like basically an amount that was quote unquote small enough by the standards of what happened that it didn't raise eyebrows too like large. And then the actual transfer got made and the CEO never requested it. So like another old hack being being brought into the being brought into the digital era, basically.
Yeah,
Or into the, not the digital era, but the AI era.
I kid you not, I got an email today, which was exactly using that attack vector. It wasn't actually to me, it was to our accounts payable. It was, past due, avoid late fees. Hello, as requested, please find the attached past due invoice for business coaching and development plus VIP membership for Eric Osterman. They're asking $50,000 and they're saying it's past due. So
Well, this was even worse. This was like an email from the CEO to the CFO.
oh, got
And
it. Yeah.
it was like, hey, Eric, I need you to make
Yeah.
this transfer for me today. We'll get caught up with the paperwork on it in the morning, but it needs to happen before 2 p.m. Please get it
Yeah.
done, that kind of thing. And and the CFO unwittingly sent the transfer, which is not good. So I will. Which is
Oh.
why I'm not mentioning the company, but that money was like the fraud department somehow got it back, but they it could have very easily not been a happy ending.
Yeah. I mean, it's probably an incredibly lucrative type of scam that we're going to see for a long time to come. I don't know that the techniques and the technology just advance the hack itself. What was I going to say? All right, so that was that. Next one was something where I was like, okay, that's kind of cool. And it was, trending on Hacker News this week. It's a in-browser port of Postgres that uses local storage. It's by Supabase. And I'm sure they have other, reasons for it. Obviously, everyone immediately ties it to AI and why that this is important for AI. I'll just, I'll take their word on it. I don't, or somebody here can inform me on that. But the very simple case is just, man, wow, I wish I had this, 20 years ago when I was learning Postgres or, SQL. What a phenomenal way to learn SQL for anyone who wants to do it. So here's just an example of me. Anyone can go there. You go to postgres.new, you log in with GitHub, it would have been enough if you could just do that. But then they added the AI layer, which made this demo just so like, wow, it had the wow factor. So yeah, I just wrote this here. Create a database schema for an online store selling widgets. All right, easy question, right, for any AI. Here's the SQL that was generated. It's hidden by default, and it summarizes what it did. Here's the schema that was created, you can see. And now you can start interacting with that. So can you now, populate that with some mock data? Cool. So here's what it did. It inserted some customer data, some product data, some order data. And then, I didn't want to have to figure out how to use this UI here. So I asked, well, can you just give me a list of customers now that I have? And here's what's in there. So, yeah, a pretty cool way of learning. Now, for the other use cases, what are some other cool use cases of this? Can someone else fill me in? Like, why do I want Postgres in my project?
Maybe you have some sort of web app that needs like robust local storage, but it's okay if it's ephemeral.
Yeah, it could
Like
simplify
that might be,
them.
yeah. One a tangentially related thing that I just saw recently is that new versions of Chrome actually have in JavaScript actually have window.ai. They're shipping with like an LLM built into the browser,
Really?
and you can actually like call window.ai, ask or whatever, I forget what the method is, and you send in a query, and it their like small model actually responds back to you completely within your browser. And I think it's like a stripped down version of Gemini is the model that they ship with it, which is just crazy.
That is, and just more of what we're going to see to come.
Yeah.
I know it would be a really fun use case of this. A honeypot that has a lot of SQL injections on there and keep all the script kiddie busy. We'd like to inform you that we just detected a SQL injection on your site. No, you just hacked yourself, dude.
Yeah. Although, yeah, I don't know, like I assume this all just runs as like a WASM worker or something like in the background. So you're
Apparently it was
limited by the
collaboration.
resources.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Apparently it was also a collaboration with SQLite or something. They needed some changes made to get this whole thing working. So yeah, that's probably it. All right. Next announcement is I'm smacked.
SQLite is one of those like one of those projects that like the entire internet relies on that like two guys maintain. It's like crazy if you go look at that, like who runs on that, you know, that XKCD cartoon that we always talk about, like that's one of those projects that there's like one guy who wrote it like 35 years ago, and apparently he knows like 90% of what goes on in SQLite, and he might be the only one.
Wow, that is interesting. Is there any site that tracks that kind of like I don't know how one would like SQLite is an easier maybe dependency to track, and the all the language frameworks have some of that built in. But I think across the board, it's kind of hard to identify those dependencies. Like I was surprised to find out Poker or the PCRE library has been maintained in a similar situation. We had on office hours by some guy who's been doing it for like 60 years, or no, I'm exaggerating, but he's 85 or something, and retiring. How does one, where are these things tracked? I think they're just tracked on Reddit. All right. Now, this is one that had me gobsmacked. I could have sworn, like, hasn't .internal been reserved for a long time? Is it only now? Am I misunderstanding this? So this was also something on Hacker News that was trending, that it's officially now reserved.
So a while ago, there was a company using .dev. I forgot which company it was. And then Google registered .dev and made it a TLD, and all of their .dev broke. So, yeah, I forgot which company it was, but and I forgot what they migrated to. They might have actually spotted a domain after that, but
Yeah.
yeah.
So this is kind of like RFC 1918 for DNS.
Yeah, I
All
looked
right.
up the other ones. It looks like dot localhost and dot example are other ones that you could leverage too that are reserved, just like
Okay.
dot in
Yeah.
general.
I think dot local and dot home are both reserved as well, if
Oh,
I'm
cool.
wrong on
Yeah, it
that.
wasn't across the whole list, but I saw oh, sorry, you know, I'm using Gemini AI, so maybe take that with a grain of salt.
I know what you mean. Yeah. All right. Next announcement was I forgot to actually look further into this one, really. This was shared in SweetOps as well. So Slack has developed their own operator that builds upon stateful sets and implements a rollout capability. This reminds me of the rollout Argo CD rollouts, which work on deployments and make it easier to do kind of blue-green deployments in Argo CD. Well, this is now an operator to do that for stateful sets. Apparently, some of the problems they ran into at their scale was just the very slow rollouts of stateful sets, which were necessarily one pod at a time. And I could imagine, you know, if you're running, you know, clusters of thousands, that's going to be untenable. So now you can control the rollout behavior using this operator. All right, any questions on this? And yeah, this one might stoke some conversation. So I think this is interesting because this was trending in my LinkedIn this week. I guess this came out a couple months ago. And one of the topics in office hours in the past couple of weeks was on Terraliths and why you want to break your Terraform root modules into smaller ones. And a point that Matt Calhoun raised on that was, well, I mean, yeah, that's how you would fix it with Terraform in its current incarnation, how Terraform currently works. Some of the other issues we brought up was, yeah, it was like when OpenTofu is proposing adding support for iteration over providers, and we raised the concern that that's going to create potentially some really slow Terraform that will be brittle and hit API rate limits and so forth. Matt's point was, yeah, but the language shouldn't, how do you say, my point was that we shouldn't therefore implement it because of those problems. Matt's point was, yeah, but that's not the choice of the language. The language should enable you to do whatever architecture you want, and we should just improve Terraform as a tool to support those use cases. All right. So if you remember that conversation, I just bring that up because it kind of ties into this a little bit. So Terraform graphs become very large. You know, we've talked about the Terraliths. Today I saw some posts on LinkedIn also calling them the kitchen sink root modules, the root modules that do everything for you. And they become very slow. And Terraform doesn't know natively what it is you are changing when you're changing the code. It has to replan the entire graph every time. So this person is proposing, well, what if Terraform were extended to support this dash light flag that somehow would understand the files that were actually modified and only try and update the graph for the modified resources based on those files? And I thought it was an interesting idea. I hadn't thought about it before. Obviously, there's a lot of nuances. Like, there's a lot of version control systems other than Git. This would probably be a very Git-centric feature. Some of the other tooling around Terraform has started to add this kind of capability as well. Why I think it's also kind of interesting is, well, one thing that is really nice with Terraliths is you don't have to solve the whole dependency ordering thing. You know, you can rely on the Terraform graph when you need it. And then you get the performance benefits of working on a small segment of the code, of the root, of the Terraform code itself, that actually is what's planned and applied. And when you want to, you can always do a complete reconciliation and plan. Anyways, thoughts on this, anyone? Has anyone else seen this article?
My first take after reading it was, this is just going to lead to tons and tons of Terraform drift out there, because like, it's going to have to get really smart to try to figure out like what changed. You know, there's a reason that all those plans are happening. It's basically because Terraform can't calculate the DAG without actually like the graph, like without actually talking to, you know, planning all those things down and talking to remote state and talking to the cloud and doing the three-way dance to figure out what needs to get changed. So I'm not sure that I see how this is going to actually work.
I could only imagine the number of issues opened up by people ranting that it's not working for them for some reason.
Yeah.
I didn't get a chance to look at what some of the comments are here, so I'm curious if anybody. All
I
right.
think the problem is that when you change something in you change a resource, like the things that are affected by changing the resource cannot easily be derived by looking at just the files that were changed on disk. And I think that that's the biggest danger here, in trying to figure this all out. So.
Yeah. What was it? Oops, I'm on the wrong post. Second. I thought it had some idea of like a checksum approach. It's
Yeah,
obviously a macro.
from each resource's code definition, right? So it's basically saying like, if I have three resources like A, B, and C, and it's saying like if the hash of the inputs of resource A change, then all I need to do is target apply A. And what you may not realize is that, B relies on A, C relies on B. And A relies on C, I mean D relies on C, and then you have this transitive, like this transitive relationship that can't be like discerned just by looking at only the attribute map of what changed in A. Like unless you also calculate the entire DAG to figure out what relies on what. And that's the reason they do that, is so that they know like when, that's why you don't have to explicitly add a depends on to every single resource you use. It's because the DAG can calculate when one thing references another thing's inputs or outputs, and then that is then affected. And then like this can cascade all the way through to locals, to outputs, to state, like we're talking about, all sorts of things. I just don't see how this is going to actually like work in the real world. I mean, I understand how it works in the most simplistic cases, but it just doesn't seem like it would work at scale to me. But maybe, maybe I'm being too cynical given what I've what my experience has been in the past.
Yeah, the Terraform docs state it's only to be used for exceptional circumstances. So I don't see this as like a supported feature, but who knows?
Well, in its current state, right? That's basically like targeted applies in their current state, yes, for sure. But I think the suggestion is that Terraform and OpenTofu both modify like default behavior or some sort of opt-in behavior that lets you like do this to speed up the speed up the plan and apply cycle. I don't think anyone is actually like suggesting that you should always just use targeted plans and applies to make this happen. But even in that scenario where code is modified of the of the actual binary, I just don't see how the problem gets solved without constantly calculating the DAG and calculating the DAG and seeing the current state of the DAG versus the expected state of the DAG is what takes the most time, and that's what's necessary to figure out if you need to mutate any resources. Like that's kind of what the
Yeah.
that's the crux of the problem in my mind. So maybe I'm oversimplifying it.
So I think if this were to be attempted, I think the first attempt should be a pilot, just a CLI that first figures out how to do targeted plans based on what changed in Git, and then runs Terraform and see if that actually works in practice before taking apart the Terraform core and trying to add this kind of thing.
There's a comment that attempts to show like a POC of how to do that in that OpenTofu thread that you were
Oh, there was
reading.
one. Yeah.
Yeah, someone talked about like piping outputs to JQ and then using set and awk to try to identify things, and doing a bunch of stuff, but at the root, I just don't see how this actually solves the problem. Like, yeah, I don't know. I'm being overly negative about the idea, but it just doesn't seem like it would work to me.
Yeah.
I think what we need to do is we need to break down state into like individual state for like every resource, and then like the vast majority of these problems go away.
Yeah, which was that thing we were talking about last time.
Yeah.
Yeah, or just have like a state backend that continually refreshes on its own, and then have Terraform query that.
Yeah. I could only imagine the amount of load. I'm curious what the kind of load Terraform is putting on infrastructure providers because of the brute force attack it takes. All right, last announcement is one close to home. So we've been working on this for the last month or so. We've had our documentation for a long time, but it's been reserved for customers. And we decided to pull the trigger and open it all up. So granted, some of it is really most relevant if you have one of our paid reference architectures. But at least now we've made it less opaque. You can see exactly what it is you get and how the steps you'd follow to bring up the Cloud Posse reference architecture, some of the tutorials around that, and so forth. We've also introduced some interesting ways that you can get your hands on our reference architecture. And we talk about those under Learn. So when you go to Learn here, you can choose your path. And Cloud Posse provides two ways right now. One is the quick start. It's a DIY, fully implemented by you. You can basically do it today without even reaching out to us. Others have done it. They've reverse engineered from all of our other like modules and components, all the configuration. Or you can sponsor Cloud Posse on GitHub, and we generate it for you based on a set of design decisions that we review with you and the team. And we hand you a fully working AWS reference architecture based on Atmos, Cloud Posse's tooling, and our open source. So if that sounds interesting, definitely reach out to Cloud Posse or me on Slack and happy to answer your questions. In the meantime, check out the docs. Maybe some places I can direct your attention would be, if you go here to like the quick start, if you go to watching the handoffs, you can go through all the handoff videos that we have so far that introduce the problem as we saw it, things we had considered in implementing everything, and then our solution. That will give you the best overview of everything. Let's see what else. Yeah, start there and let me know. Any questions on this? All right. With that, then we are ready for Q&A. Any questions and answers?
Oh, one thing I was just going to add to your announcements is there's some Windows Zero Day that got published yesterday. Oh. So if you have my takeaway was if you basically have IPv6 enabled on your home network and you have a Windows computer, you're potentially vulnerable. Basically, if you have newer router or modem, you might be vulnerable. You may just want to update. And I already had the update apparently on my Windows machine. And I imagine most people here are on Linux or macOS, so probably not impacted, but yeah.
Zero click remote code execution vulnerability on Windows. Wow. 9.8 out of 10. So yeah, that's about as bad as they get.
Yeah. So if you just run your updates as usual or have it enabled already, you probably already have it, but in case you do manual, you might want to kick it off.
Yeah. Does this one have a nice witty name, like Ping of Death?
I did not come across any cool names on it. not being exploited yet, but the
oh, okay.
Yeah, one of the good guys found it, reported it, and they've already patched it. But now that it's been patched and it's known, I guess the idea is someone will figure it out. And yeah.
I thought it maybe it was related to DEF CON. It would have been interesting, but it was the thing about. All right.
I wonder how much the bounty pays, if there is one.
All right. Any questions that we can get answered? Go for it, Evans.
Sure. This is probably a contentious discussion, but what do people like for CD tools these days? I'm often defaulting to GitHub Actions because a lot of people use GitHub. I liked GitLab CI better, but whatever. And it seems like the CD ecosystem is still in like a weird, crappy state. I don't know. Anybody got opinions?
Yeah, definitely opinions. I want others to chime in first.
Well, I should specify. I'm looking for specifically what I would love to find is a kind of the most free open sourcey of the things, right? Like Jenkins is self-hostable and free and open source, but it's old as hell and nobody likes it. GitLab CI is free open source, you know, whatever. You have to self-host your own GitLab instance to do it, right? And then I know there's some nascent ones like, you know, Tecton and some other junk. But yeah, if anyone has any recommendations, I am definitely all ears.
And this is for CD, right, Evans?
Yeah, specifically for taking your code and doing something with it, right? Pipelines, workflows, whatever you want to call them.
Yeah. I'm a huge fan of GitHub Actions, so a bit biased there. And you end up finding actions for a lot of different platforms as well. So whatever the tool chain is you're using or the deployment service, you can usually find an action that someone's made. So there's that benefit, which I like a lot of. And I haven't used a whole lot of the other tools, so maybe someone else could chime in there. But I'm personally a huge fan of GitHub Actions and having that part of the process itself.
Yeah, my main beef with GitHub Actions is just their marketplace is terrible. And yeah, you can find a thing for anything. It's like NPM stuff, kind of early days NPM, right? Like I can find an action for anything, but it may be written by like who knows who with one contributor and like no stars, and the marketplace doesn't really help you figure out what's going on. So I have to look at, then I look at their code and like the code, for some of them, the code is like, let's say GitHub Action to install AWS CLI, you know? The code might be like curl the C thing and like what it might be 5 lines of like a bash script, or it could be like some weird Node.js thing that does who knows what. And again, like I find it hard to be security conscious and still use GitHub Actions. I feel like I want to fall back to just doing like pipeline.sh and just putting all the crap in my own bash script, which is then translatable to whatever future CD tool may come into play. I don't know.
You need Earth point. Oh, sorry. Okay.
Yes, I'm going to say, Evans, your comment around security, that's a really good point. When you're using GitHub Actions, given how easy it is to have stuff published, there's no verification. A lot of people do not pin their dependencies, like the SHAs, or sometimes their nesting actions or things like that. And yeah, you kind of have to dig into the code and go deep and then also have some best practices on your end as you're referencing it. So yeah, just want to say I agree. And I do see that quite often. So yeah.
Are you fine with bringing your own compute?
What do you mean? Like using GitHub runners, kind of? Something like that?
Yeah, using your own runners or using...
Yeah, that's preferable, honestly. Like my preference would be self-hosted runners, self-hosted CI/CD tool, and then, you know, like open source kind of code modules, whatever. So GitHub Actions is all open source. Like the mods, the marketplace and the GitHub Actions things are open source. A lot of them are not really well vetted and they just seem like, you know, there's like 20 sketchy actions to do a thing and which one is the right one, you know? So, yeah.
but if I, take your own argument against you a little bit on pipeline.sh, you can do this, you can do that and use GitHub Actions and now you're just as secure. Like using third-party actions is a choice and vetting them is, you know, optional. But if plan B is just building a shell script, well, great. do that, and now stick that shell script in GitHub Actions. automation.
Ideally, I guess I just like for the marketplace to be a little bit more vetted, which it's getting there. You know, again, I have to do it all myself, right? Like I go on marketplace. I usually don't even search GitHub Marketplace for Actions. I search in GitHub and, you know, just GitHub Actions and the thing I want to do. And then I like look for the one with the most stars, most contributors, whatever, kind of skim it, you know, see if it looks reasonable. And yeah, pinning the thing to a version is good, but then you got to manage with updating GitHub Actions. And there's actually a GitHub Action to update your actions too, but I haven't tested that yet. Anyway.
So I guess,
back to the top level question, what if you were doing Greenfield right now, what's your choice of CD tool? GitHub Actions, GitLab CI, or some Jenkins or something else? And maybe why?
For me, Greenfield, my choice would be Dagger. And here's why. For me, the thing that I struggle the most with CI are two things. Being able to locally test my workflow and not have to push, fail, push, fail, push, fail, push, fail, before it finally works. So with Dagger, I can do everything locally, and I just write code in the language that I like. Then the other
thing, I haven't heard of this one.
The other thing that I care about is the caching. Like if I have things that I want them to really fast and they don't change that much, it allows me to do that. So Greenfield, that's probably where I would go.
Thanks for the suggestion. Yeah, I haven't heard of that one. I'll check it out.
It's a, so Dagger is, a, I think it's just Dagger HQ. It's by the founder of Docker.
IO. Dagger IO. Yeah.
Also, Isaac, just a heads up, you have a kind of persistent click every second when you're talking.
I just wanted to add something really quickly to this is that for the existence of DevOps tools that have had marketplaces, they've sucked. So I wouldn't hold out hope that the GitHub marketplace is going to get any better. I mean, if you go back to like the Chef Kitchen and the Ansible Galaxy or whatever that was called, and Salt has it, and they've got it for, you know, the Terraform module registry, and, you know, dot dot dot, they've all been a free-for-all, and you're sort of on your own to figure out like kind of what are the best contributions to the ecosystem. And I think package managers are the same way. Like if you look at the entire package management ecosystem, you have no idea without, like, the reason that we look at like GitHub stars is because that's at least usually some sort of indicator that a bunch of people are using it, right? You know, but short of that, like there is no easy way to get community trust that a particular tool you want to use you know, is being used, is adopted, is doing reasonably sane things, you know, dot, 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 all the things that we look for in there. So if you're not willing to roll your own, and I think daggers are actually a really good choice for doing that, then I think then you still have to do all the background work of vetting the particular actions and things that you want to use, even if you find them in the GitHub marketplace or whatever. Like I personally at this point think GitHub is the best runner system behind like getting all this stuff going, like, or at least the easiest to use and all of those things. But that doesn't necessarily mean that like it's the best functionality, like it has the easiest way to perform all the functionality that you want to perform, but it is the easiest way to kind of like, when this event occurs in my source code, I want to do this, you know, this Y thing. It kind of seems, like the best choice out there right now. But,
yeah,
you know, the state of the marketplace is the state of the marketplace, unfortunately.
We're getting there. I am happy with all the YAML-y bits. As much as people hate YAML, like at least it's like easy and consistent. All right. Well, cool. I'll check out Dagger, and I'll keep hacking away on GitHub Actions. And if it pains me too much, then yeah, I'm probably going to end up kind of rolling my own and using GitHub Actions as like the framework for it. But hopefully not, because I'm lazy and I don't want to roll my own. There's lots of smart people in the world. They've already done it. So yeah.
I think somebody else might have also mentioned Earthly, but it's,
I think I might have said something about that too. That was the other one I was going to mention. It's very similar to Dagger. Like the idea is basically that there are kind of reusable things to do. A lot of the same things you do every day, like building a Docker container, tagging it, pushing it, you know, running tests, doing whatever. You can do all those things, run them locally, and then also run the same thing in CI using some sort of runner like GitHub or Circle or whatever, you know, you choose to do that. That's probably like one of those tools is probably your best, you know, your best bet.
Was Waypoint the one that HashiCorp was working on? That was like they refused to give it a name.
Yeah. Waypoint, I think, is the thing that they're doing that, but that's like a hosted platform for doing this. It's not exactly like
there was a CLI that they were working on.
I think it got rolled into Waypoint. Like Waypoint is meant to kind of be like, I think, like a backstage replacement, or you know, it's going after that kind of space. I'm not saying it's like, you know, feature for feature competing with it, but it's supposed to be like your internal platform, and you're supposed to do whatever you need to do, like running against that that dev platform.
Yeah.
Hey, how did you get that look? That's a cool repo look.
Oh no, this is the new repository view.
GitHub. I haven't seen it like that. That's weird.
Came out a couple months ago, I think. It was in a beta before that.
Oh, I'm not opted into it. I still have the old
version. The old view. I believe this is the default.
I'm looking at it right now. I'm still looking at it the old way. That's weird.
Maybe it is something I opted into then.
There's a toggle on the right side, Matt. I don't know if you have to. If that's
yeah, I know the thing you're talking about. Maybe I just don't have. I'm not opted into it. But yeah, I have like still the old view.
Wasn't that Waypoint? Anybody know? Yeah, I think, let's see here. Oh, public archive. Ha! Well, that was not, we missed that on office hours. Interesting. So this was one of Mitchell.
I think there must be something else because like Waypoint is still listed on their product page as like an internal developer platform that they're selling.
Yeah, but okay, so let me describe the thing that I'm thinking of, and I'm pretty sure it is Waypoint. And it's not contradictory with what you're saying, Matt, and it's explained by this being archived. So Mitchell Hashimoto, one of his last hurrahs at HashiCorp was building a new tool that was simplifying the developer experience of defining the various stages of an application. And it was announced at one of the HashiConfs, and I think it was this Waypoint product, but they refused to call it CI/CD, CI or CD, and everyone was confused on what it was. Even the last HashiConf that I was at a few years ago, that was the case, or a couple years ago. Now it looks like that project, as it was, has been archived. So I think they are continuing to invest in it, to Matt's point, maybe, but now as a closed source product.
I think it is no longer a CLI. It is now a platform that has plugins and all of those things like Backstage has. Yeah. Like, and there, I think they pitch it as like your internal, like, internal developer platform or something like that.
Yeah, introduction to Waypoint. That was 3 years ago they announced it. And yeah, it was a CLI at that point. Looked kind of cool. I was excited about it, but it never went anywhere in that version. All right. Any other questions? Well, are we good on? No, we're at time basically. So probably not worth starting another conversation unless somebody has a really quick question. All right, then. Well, thanks, everyone, for attending Office Hours today. We'll be posting a recording of this session in a couple hours to our YouTube channel. Just go to youtube.com/cloudposse, and you'll find it posted there. If you haven't subscribed, do that. It helps us out a great deal. And if you're curious about Cloud Posse and how we can help move the needle for you at your organization using our reference architecture for AWS, book a meeting with me directly by going to cloudposse.com/meet. Again, cloudposse.com/meet. Here are a few other action items. If you're interested in getting more involved with our community, we have our Slack community, which is at slack.cloudposse.com. It's a public community you can join. You have access to our podcast, which is at podcast.cloudposse.com. Those are just these recordings as audio podcasts, so you can listen to them on Spotify or, you know, however you listen to your podcasts. And if you haven't registered for these office hours, you can do that also by going to cloudposse.com/office hours. Again, cloudposse.com/office hours. Thanks, everyone. Have a great rest of your week and see you next week.